want to talk about the European click today. The European click, what is it? These are some of the things that you need to know about today.
Israel should lift its unjustified restrictions on the West Bank economy, promptly transfer the withheld clearance revenues, and stop undermining the governance capacity of the Palestinian Authority.
That data center, once completed, will draw about 9 gigawatts of power. All the manufacturing in Utah, all the ski lifts, all of it use less than half that amount of electricity.
Insane how many people are distraught, can't sleep at night.
All this and a whole lot more right here on The Sanchez Effect. What do you say we do this? Hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. And, you know, I've come to a realization about Europe and about European leaders. I'm not from Europe. I'm from America, right? But I've been looking at this a lot, and I'm starting to realize that they're all pretty much the same over there. It is, in a word, a clique. A clique, right? That's what they've become. Europe is run by the EU, it's run by NATO, and it's run by the EIB and other nondescript bodies, right? Filled with people who were literally thrown out by the citizens of the countries they governed. And then they go to those institutions, right? Look at Keir Starmer, perfect example. 80% of the British citizens say they don't like this guy. They don't like him. They don't want him. So they threw him out, right? So what's he doing now? He's using his people's money, about $15 billion, to try to buy his way into a new appointed gig at NATO. By the way, he's not the only one. Ursula von der Leyen, right? Unelected. Kaya Kallas, unelected. Mark Rutte, the head of NATO right now, unelected, right? And speaking of Rutte, I got something for you. Apparently, the guy's not sleeping well these days, and I feel terrible for him. Sleep is very important to your health. Look what he just, this is what he just told, this happened like within 24 hours, by the way, just before we went on the air. Look what he just told a Turkish news agency.
I generally try to sleep, but if there's one thing that keeps me awake, it's Russia. Unfortunately, the main threat we face in the long term is Russia. We see this clearly in the senseless war of aggression that Russia is waging against Ukraine.
He can't sleep because, never mind that NATO, the organization he leads, has attacked, invaded, been at war with 5 times more countries than Russia has. Not only that, but Russia hasn't threatened NATO, hasn't threatened Europe. It's quite the contrary. In fact, Russia has actually asked to be let into NATO. They've said, let us join you. So we're a part of your, you know, clique, I guess. So if what he's saying is not true, why does he say it, right? Why does he say it? Why would somebody say something like that? Why is he scaring his people into thinking that Russia's about to attack any day now? Well, because it's what his clients, weapons makers, bankers, that's what they want him to say. That's what they need him to say. You know? There's another guy like this, another suspected cad, as I like to call him, that I want to talk about. This idea came to me while I was having a conversation with my colleague, Che Bose. You know, Che and I do this thing called Eye on Europe once a week, every day here, and we talk about Europe. And actually, he's been teaching me a lot about the spirit of Europe, you know? So remember, all these guys that we talk about in Europe, they all have close ties to the weapons makers, and all of them, not coincidentally here, it's no coincidence, they're all into now building up their military to supposedly defend themselves against the Soviet Union. Yeah, I know. It's not called the Soviet Union anymore. But do you think they care? They just want a scare tactic. They just need a reason to be able to make more bombs so that the people who make the bombs can pay them money in their campaigns and they can keep their jobs, get rich, and the hell with the people they lead. That's just the way it is. Here's my conversation with Che yesterday.
Finns have actually announced, and check out this headline, they've announced that they're going to allow, for the first time, nuclear weapons to be stationed in their country, okay? And this is a big, big deal. The initial statement, though, you need us to protect you, turned into, hey, why don't you park that nuclear missile in our backyard? We're happy to take it. Because the leader of Finland, this guy Alexander Stubb, has become an exquisitely Russophobic cheerleader for the war in Ukraine, for ramping up this Finnish militarism against Russia.
Militarism, right? That's what he said. Yeah, there's Che. He's good. So he talked about a guy named Alexander Stubb. Who is Alexander Stubb? Answer, he's a carbon copy of Rutte and of von der Leyen and of Macron and of Merz and of Starmer. He's an Atlantist, which means he's a guy with a sophisticated superiority complex over Russia, China, India, and most other non-European countries. In other words, to him and those other people just like him, if you ain't European, if you ain't American, if you ain't Canadian, if you ain't Australian, you ain't crap. You just don't matter. They're superior. That's how they feel. So let me tell you what else I know about Stubbs. He's pro-NATO. He is pro-EU. He is pro-EIB. Essentially, he's a Europhile. He's part of that clique I was talking about. He's an elitist. He's part of a revolving door of politicians. These people can, seriously, they can spend their entire lives without ever having to get a real job. They never have to have a real job. They never have to work with real people because they're these in these institutions. In Stubbs' case, look, he went from elected position in Finland to an appointed position in the European Investment Bank to then another appointment in the European University Institute. Now he's back in office in Finland doing deals with bankers and weapons manufacturers. You see what I mean by revolving door? This guy fits that pattern to a T. Okay, so there's another pattern I want to tell you about today, because I love talking about these things. When you see them, you should explain them to people, because most news organizations, they're not gonna break this kind of stuff down for you, right? Because and this is another one that pits elitist billionaires against people like us, just people who work, everyday people. And in this case, this is happening in the United States of America. And oh, you know what? It's causing scenes all over the place. People are getting really angry, and it's causing scenes like this. Watch this.
No data center! No data center!
Insane how many people are distraught, can't sleep at night, crying.
What data centers are doing, they're increasing our electricity bills, they're taking our water, it's across the nation.
It's not right that they went to XAI to see that they have 35 gas turbines operating and polluting our air.
How's your water situation here?
Tainted. It tastes weird. It's just not the same.
Do you think it has to do with the data center, the construction?
Well, yeah, they have them 2 24-inch pipes pumping water across the street over here. They're dewatering, as they call it, so they can put the foundations in.
So what is this about? Data centers, you heard it. And by the way, can you imagine if they put one of these next to your house? Can you imagine waking up and trying to go to sleep every day, 24/7, with just that sound that they describe? Some say it's like a ringing. Others say it's like a buzz. Others say it's like a hum that's always in the background, like the all day long. And you're trying to raise your kids and live your life. So, yeah, the public anger in the United States right now is real about this. According to Gallup, 70% of Americans, 70% of Americans are now angry about these data centers in their area. There's the breakdown, right? And why? Well, obviously, the noise. Wow. Which means that they're never going to be able to sell their homes. If somebody puts one of these data centers next to your home, you're not going to be able to sell your home. I mean, that's crazy, right? At least not for a decent price. But these centers are also ripping them off because these centers are using vast quantities of the city's water. They use vast quantities of the city's electricity. So these giant, monstrous building complexes come into their neighborhoods, sometimes right next door to them. The people who live in those neighborhoods, they never even agreed to it, but they're going to have to end up paying for it. Why? Well, because the billionaires who are behind this AI cloud demand thing, they're getting tax breaks. They don't have to pay. They're getting utility breaks. They don't have to pay the electricity, right? And they're getting these breaks from the politicians who run the town. Payoff, you think? I didn't say it, but if the shoe fits. Take the case of one giant complex they're putting in Utah. This is it right here. Look at the size of this thing. That's just a part of it. Keep in mind, the owners of this data center, they're getting this massive utility break. They get exemptions. They get discounted bulk energy rates, which means, essentially, the citizens of Utah are going to pay for their bills. Here's my friend Tucker Carlson explaining this particular case.
That data center, which is basically a series of interconnected, low-slung, vinyl-clad warehouses in which sit not people making things, but computers computing things. That data center, once completed, will draw about 9 gigawatts of power. How much is a gigawatt? Well, it's a billion watts. It's one step from a terawatt, which is a trillion watts. 9 gigawatts. Now, how much is 9 gigawatts? Well, 9 gigawatts is more than twice what the entire state of Utah now uses. Every human being in the millions of people who live in Utah, all of them combined, all the manufacturing in Utah, all the ski lifts, all of it, every air conditioning unit, every electric heater, every Tesla, all of them combined use less than half that amount of electricity.
Yeah, see, I was flabbergasted by that because I wasn't paying a lot of attention to this data center story until I heard, think about that, twice the amount of electricity used by all the people of the state of Utah is what that data center in Utah is going to be using. So once again, the average working person is getting screwed. They have to pay more. Their home is now worth less. And their quality of life just sucks. And who's behind these giant clusters, these giant data centers that are being built literally in people's backyards? Guess what? It's the same cast of characters that you have come to know. When you hear their names, you're going to go, oh, yeah, I got it. The kind of people who can buy whoever they want and whatever they want because they're different. Some say they're the Epstein class. They're multimillionaires who are now billionaires vying to become, with this deal, trillionaires. Trillionaires. I got them for you. You want to look at them? Want to see who they are? Start with Sam Altman. He owns OpenAI. How much do you need, right? How many billions do you need? Mark Zuckerberg, Meta, Elon Musk, XAI, Steve Schwarzman, Blackstone, Larry Ellison, Mr. IDF, Oracle, Michael Intrader, CoreWeave, Jeff Bezos, Amazon, Chase Lockmiller, Crusoe Energy. Obviously, there's going to be more than just these guys. There's probably going to be more people involved. But these guys right here, you see right there, those are the oligarchs. Those are the oligarchs. They are the engine behind the fight now playing out in cities all over America. A fight that's going to offer to you, if you see it this way, or push down your throat, depending if you see it that way. This all depends on how you think of AI, right? By the way, there's something else about AI that I need to tell you about. Because remember that this AI future that's being sold to us, it's being built in conjunction with media companies also owned by the people that I just named above. What do I mean by that? Think about this. Because when I go right now here to, you know, ChatGPT on my Mac, right, I realize that the information they're giving to me has been coalesced information that came from the media companies, you know, New York Times, Reuters, CNN, all of those places, from those media companies those guys own. So the guys I just shown you who are going to own the data centers, who are going to own AI, also own the media companies from whence the AI information comes from. So in other words, all the stuff that's going to come to us through AI, seems to me, I see it all the time when I go there, comes with a bias. And whose bias is it? Their bias. You know, there's one more important note today that I want to share with you, and it's about China, because I see this all the time lately. They used to never do this, but they're doing this a lot now. China is once again asserting itself. I mean, and it's doing now, especially this on the world stage, as a voice of reason in a region where only bullying tactics have previously prevailed. Yesterday, for example, China's representative to the United Nations gave a tongue-lashing to Israel, just as three more Palestinian children were killed by Israel within the past 24 to 48 hours. And by the way, this is not me saying this. The whole world now jointly refers to what they're doing as a genocide, whether they like it or not. That's just the term that's being used. Here's China's UN diplomat just yesterday, last night, getting in the face of the Israelis and telling them directly, enough.
Israel continues its bombardment and military operations while expanding its occupation. More than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza since the ceasefire agreement broke out, with, on average, one child losing his or her life every day. The humanitarian situation in Gaza remains catastrophic. Essential supplies are in critically short supply, sanitary conditions are appalling, and more than 2 million people are struggling to survive amid the rubble. Israel must fulfill its obligations under international humanitarian law as the occupying power, lift restrictions on humanitarian access, and support and facilitate the delivery of assistance by humanitarian agencies. In the West Bank, the occupying power has accelerated settlement expansion, tolerated settler violence, and continued to encroach upon Palestinian territory. We urge Israel to immediately cease all settlement activities, curb settler violence, and ensure serious accountability for attacks. Israel should lift its unjustified restrictions on the West Bank economy, promptly transfer the withheld clearance revenues, and stop undermining the governance capacity of the Palestinian Authority. The two-state solution is the only viable path to resolving the question of Palestine. It cannot be denied, nor can it be replaced.
You know, they're strong words, but I got to tell you, I could never be a UN diplomat, because if they gave me something that I had to read, I wouldn't be able to read it. I couldn't be just talking and looking down. I can't do that. My producers hate me, because whatever we write or whatever they write, I always change it while I'm talking, not to mention whoever we have on the teleprompter. But just saying. Okay, when we come back, speaking of things I'm thinking about right now, we're going to be joined by a U.S. Army veteran whose voice can now be heard clearly and loudly around the world. And what he is saying comes from his own personal experience of what needs to be said and what needs to be done, not just about the wars that he's fought in, but also some of the ones that are taking place now in places like Lebanon and in Iran and, you know, in Ukraine and in other places. And we're going to talk about that with him when we come right back. Don't go away. And as promised, I want to bring in now Matthew Ho. Matthew is a U.S. Marine, and he's also had tours of duty as a combat veteran, former State Department official, political analyst, who in 2009 resigned in protest against the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. And I am so happy to be able to welcome him back to the show. Matthew, it's so nice of you to take time to take us through some of the things that are going on in the world right now. And who better than you to talk about them?
Well, thanks, Rick. I appreciate you having me back on.
What do you think? Maybe we ought to start with what's going on right now in Iran, vis-a-vis Lebanon, vis-a-vis Israel, and, of course, affecting the United States. What is your take right now on where that situation is? Are we looking at a resolution? Because Mr. Trump says we're close. The Iranians are saying we've got nothing. We're not even going to the meetings. What's happening?
Right. Just real quick, I want to say two things about your monologue, because it was fantastic. But that's the single best definition I've ever heard of the Atlanticists before. Perfectly encapsulates who those people are. And then the other point that you made, that last point, Rick, about artificial intelligence and the danger of the authority of it and the fact that it will control the narrative. It will determine who is correct, who is right, what the history was. That is the most dangerous aspect of AI in a whole basket right, of snakes that we're dealing with here. So I appreciate that. But with this MOU, I think what we're seeing established is essentially a modus vivendi between Iran and the United States. Whether or not a final deal is ever actually completed, whether it's actually, you know, a big signing ceremony and Donald Trump and the Supreme Leader get together and put their signatures down on a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that's probably doubtful. But the idea being is that this provides some degree of stability. It allows both sides to claim victory. Iran has achieved what it set out to achieve in terms of its objectives of deterring, and they actually didn't deter the United States. They defeated the United States, but also to establishing control over the Straits of Hormuz. That's clear. Iran is in control of the Straits of Hormuz, and there's no changing that. As well as, too, I think Iran was looking to be reassured of its position as a regional power. And this war found it in the position now of a world power. So I think what you're seeing is that you're going to see back and forth. We're going to see tit for tat military engagements. We're going to see these spurts of diplomacy. And it's going to be a lot of two steps forward, one step back. What does this all mean for the next several months? And then I think after the election, the United States president is going to have to determine, is this war, is this peace going to be his legacy, right? And he'll spend the next couple of years protecting it. Or if he's going to decide that we've done enough, the markets have stabilized, time to try and do the war again. What they'll accomplish in a war that they couldn't accomplish back in March and April, I don't know. But I think that's where we're at.
But that's a good question for you. You're a Marine. I mean, you know what it takes to actually go in there and do something significant. And I'm saying this to you because every time I have a conversation with the Iranians, and I've had a lot of conversations with the Iranians, I don't think it's false bravado. They basically say to me, bring it on. Bring it on. If you want to basically send a land force into our country, come on. We're ready for you. Is it false bravado, or from your perspective as a Marine, as a guy who understands military, would that be a fool's errand on the part of the United States? Are the Iranians right?
Well, the Iranians are right. I caution them about their pride, right? And don't let this victory lead you down the path of arrogance that the United States has been on since World War II, right? You see what that's gotten the United States. So just some caution there.
Don't
right.
Don't become your enemy.
don't become your enemy. Exactly. Don't become the thing that you are fighting against.
Yes.
Right. And I think, Rick, that's, you know, I have two big questions in all of this. What is the White House going to do about Israel? And then the other question is, what are the Iranians going to do? They are now a world power. How are they going to present themselves? How are they going to carry out that role, right? I mean, these are big geopolitical / philosophical questions that the Iranians have to answer. They are in a new position that they weren't in 4 months ago.
But you got to give them a little bit of credit for one of the things I think they're doing. Whether you agree with them or not, for the Palestinian cause, you could be for, you know, the cause of what's going on right now in southern Lebanon. But when I talk to them, what they say to me, Matthew, is, because I will tell them, look, you got a great deal from Mr. Trump. Walk away. And they say, no, the deal has to include others. We have to put in the deal the protection of the Palestinians and the protection of southern Lebanon. Yeah. And I'm thinking, why are you doing that? I mean, it's making it harder to get this done. And they say, it's because who we are. It's who we've been for 6,000 years. That's part of our civilization. It's part of our ethos. It's part of our morality. Weird in this
right.
day and age.
You know,
but do you buy it?
Well, two things on that. One, the first is that this war was a war that the Iranians had determined, had said clearly that this would be a decisive war. I mean, we saw the Iranians exercise strategic patience for years, mm-hmm. not responding to the baits, the bullying, the provocation, the attacks by the U.S. and Israel, right? Always limiting their responses. And that, of course, I think they were still preparing. They were still building their resources. They were still getting ready, if you will. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were saying clearly that when the actual war comes, it will be decisive. So if that was your strategy, and you've seen the Iranians not only articulate objectives, but then create a strategy to achieve those objectives, you follow the strategy. And so I understand then if because I'm in the same camp as you are, Rick.
Yeah.
You know, hey, look what you've gotten, man. Like, let's, you know, take a good thing and walk away here. Right. Don't push your luck. But the other side then, too, though, getting to the Lebanese and the Palestinians is Iran is now a world power. And if they are a world power and you've had this relationship with them, isn't this now the time to use that power, this role that you have, this ability to exert influence across the globe? Isn't this now the opportunity, the time to utilize that power? And I think you've seen that with the Iranian insistence on Lebanon. We still don't know what the Iranian thresholds are, what their red lines are going to be, how they're going to react if the Israelis don't leave Lebanon or the Israelis continue to kill scores of Lebanese every day. But I think what we've also seen, though, is that they have made these statements about Palestine. But I think the Iranians also understand that their leverage only goes so far and that Palestine may be too far gone, which is, of course, heartbreaking. And the Palestinians, you know, doomed to continue to suffer. And we can certainly get into that conversation. You know, Friday will be 1,000 days since the genocide began in Gaza. And I mean, certainly the suffering of the Palestinians,
isn't that funny? Yeah. You just used that word and look how loosely you used it. A couple of years ago, you would have been afraid to use that word. But you, a very well-respected military geopolitical analyst, just threw it out there because in your heart of hearts, you are convinced that's what it is. And I'm not singling you out, Matt. This is what everybody's saying now. We're living in a world where people sit around like you and I, but in kitchen tables, and they go, oh, yeah, about Israel, and it's genocide.
Yeah. I've been there. I didn't get inside Gaza, but in 2024, I was on the fence line, and I saw what northern Gaza looked like. Beit Lahia, Beit Hanun, Jabalia, just leveled. You know, and I took part in the Iraq and Afghan wars. I've been a student of this my entire life, essentially. You know, you know genocide when you see it. I was already using that term beforehand because I understood what the Israelis were doing.
Yeah.
You know, genocide incorporates, Rick, much more than just the killing of the people. It's the killing of the society. It's the destruction of the civilization. So when you destroy, when you level, when you eradicate everything, whether it be the buildings, whether it be the vegetation, the agriculture, the trees, whether it be the statues, the cemeteries, the mosques, the churches, the schools, the universities, the fire stations, the hospitals. When you make it impossible for people to live, but also to are making a very sincere effort to erase that they were ever there to begin with. That is what genocide is, you know. So it's just not simply the mass murder of a population, of a people, like we have seen in Gaza, but also, too, this eradication of their existence, making it so there is no record that they were ever there before. And that's what most of Gaza looks now. The IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, just the other day said they control now 70% of Gaza. You have Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, saying that they have plans for settlements in Gaza. And then now, of course, you have this report stating that the Israelis are prepared, along with this farce, this board of peace, right, to move the Palestinians into, they are calling them humanitarian zones, which we all know are simply concentration camps inside the larger concentration camp that is Gaza. You know, essentially, they're ghettos. That's essentially what they are going to be living in. And you know, this is where we are again, almost 3 years after this began.
Well, I've heard people actually compare it to exactly what we saw in Poland, that the Nazis did, during World War II. They've used and people who are Holocaust survivors say, I've read my father and my mother's letters, and I can tell you that what I'm seeing in Gaza is exactly what I saw in those places. But the thing I was getting to was the nomenclature question. The idea that this word right now is being used in such a way, so it's when people all over, I mean, Vance, J.D. Vance said this just the other day. He told the Israelis, and I think he believes this, we're your only ally. The world can't stand you. You're the most hated country in the world. And I think that's as true now as it's ever been, and I don't see it ever not being true in the near future. Do you agree?
I one thing, Rick, Israeli commentators have been saying these last couple of weeks is how united the Israeli public in. They've never seen this before. They've never seen the Israeli public so united behind something, and that is their determination not to let this war end. particularly or especially the occupation, the invasion, the war in Lebanon.
Yeah.
I mean, so how do you change an entire society? How do you change an entire political state? There is no one of any political significance and no constituency in Israel with any political significance who is in favor of ending the genocide, who is not in favor of the ethnic cleansing, who doesn't see value in annexation.
And it's worse because the ones who think about, I'm just saying, and pardon me for interrupting you, but I was saying this as I was listening to your words. And the ones who are against it are leaving. Many of them have, I understand the population, I've seen the numbers. The population of Israel is shrinking. And we've seen some defections, et cetera, now in the IDF, things we wouldn't have seen in the past. So it's almost like the ones who are against it are getting the hell out, which means there's a bigger coalition of those who are then for it who remain in the country, right? Is that the math? Is that the equation?
You know, and even the ones who are remaining who may be against it or be more moderate in their views, if you will, they're only having one or two or three children. And meanwhile, the right wing, which is the majority of the population, including the settlers, the ultra-nationalists, the ultra-Orthodox, they're having four, five, six, seven children.
God, and you know listen to what you just said. They're being told, breed. Who else did that? Hitler. Hitler was famous for trying. I've seen the they called them like, what was it, baby camps or something like that, where they would tell Germans to make sure that they bred. Wow, that's that comparison.
Yeah, this is supremacy. Also, too, if you're ever there, Rick, and you're in whether it be pre-1948 Palestine or in the West Bank, and you run into these settlers, half the time, or more than half the time, almost all the time, I feel like, they sound like you and I. They're from Philadelphia.
Yeah.
They're from New York, right? They're from Los Angeles.
Miami.
So they also import these settlers who believe in this mission, who believe in this cosmic purpose. To them, this is a gift that was given to them by a magical real estate agent in the sky 3,000 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the type of religious fervor that we're dealing with here. And so this idea then that they are on a cosmic battle, a historical battle, a biblical battle, and they have to produce these families because the other side, in their opinion, is doing the same. And that's how you actually make facts on the ground, as Israelis say, is that you take and hold land. Mm. In order to take and hold land, you have to have people. And you can't, you know, during the 50s, 60s, 70s, hundreds of thousands of Jews came from all around the world. You know, many from Russia, many from other Middle Eastern countries, many from the United States. And that has greatly died down, the level of Jewish immigration into Israel. So how are you going to keep that population up as well then, too, if you're going to expand, if you really, truly believe, Rick, in greater Israel, if you believe that Israel should extend up to Beirut, up to Damascus, many of them believe, because this is what the Bible says, that Israel should go from the Nile to the Euphrates. How are you going to populate it? Who's going to control it? Who's going to be in charge? Who's going to live there? So you do have essentially this mission, if you will, by many Israeli families, particularly those who are, all those who are in belief, who hold these beliefs, but, you know, many others, that this is their duty. They have to have large families in order to see the success of the Israel project, the Zionist project that began in the late 20th century, or late 19th century, excuse me.
Yeah, and God bless them. It's good. There's nothing wrong with wanting to find some land and be with people who you are, you know, comfortable being with. That's all community. Community is good. Community is Christian. Community is a good thing. The problem is, and that ends when you start violating other people's rights to be able to achieve that. And that's the crux of this whole thing. Let's switch over to Europe, because you mentioned something about what I was describing earlier. I talked about this clique. I talked about the people who are leading these institutions that lead Europe, and they're all completely unelected. And they come from countries where they were elected, but they essentially were all but thrown out, because I've looked at their approval numbers. People like Macron, people like Starmer, people like Merz, I mean, they're 20%, 18%, 12%, 15%. So that means the ones who are elected are disliked by their populations. And the ones who are really in charge are unelected. That is not a good scenario for Europe, is it? That's not even close to being democratic.
No. You know, the popular, the and what these, as you were getting to in your conversation or your monologue, Rick, what they've turned to is militarism. Yeah. What they've turned to is both a Keynesian militarism, this idea that we're going to invest in our weapons industry, and that's going to strengthen and revitalize the European economies. And on the other side, that militarism is what will give us a political identity. And we've seen that in many ways, in particular with these leaders who, again, are incredibly unpopular, like you're saying, below 20% for many of them.
Yeah.
And this idea then that in order to distract their publics, in order to try and give them some type of political identity again, they need a foreign tyrant. They need some type of foreign threat. They need someone to point to and say, look, if we don't band together, if you don't follow me, we are going to be invaded. We are going to, right? I mean, like, it's an old storyline. It's being used for thousands of years in societies by governments. It's nothing new. And this is, rather than dealing with their publics, rather than dealing with the great underinvestment in Europe that we have seen for decades now, you know, the underinvestment in their economies and their infrastructure and their education, you know, rather than dealing with societal issues, rather than dealing with the health care and housing and wage issues that they're all dealing with, they have chosen to point to a foreign enemy and say, look over there, I'm here to protect you from that. And that doesn't work, though, because they're incredibly unpopular and people see right through. So you have this reality that these leaders, rather than, of course, they would never reconsider, they would never revisit this decision of theirs to follow militarism. They're going to double down on the militarism, right? They're going to they see that the best way is to continue to double down on this. And, you know, with regards to those who are in charge, these Atlanticists, this is the danger that many in Europe were saying going back 20 some odd years ago with NATO expansion, as well as with NATO involvement in Afghanistan and then Libya. You are going to create a hyper-militarized class of politicians within Europe that will see militarization and see militarism as their best way forward, as the thing that gets them moving along, as the thing that underwrites them, as what their foundation is, as what their identity is. And so that's why I thought your definition of Atlanticist was so spot on. But we can see a trajectory here. And I think the awful thing about all this, Rick, is that you go back 35 years or so, and the Europeans had a choice. When the Cold War ended, when the Soviet Union dissolved, the Europeans had a choice of maybe breaking out from the American Empire, no longer being vassals, and creating a Europe that was its own entity. And they chose not to. But you can certainly imagine an alternative where the Europeans had done that. And there's no reason why 35 years later, Europe is not a hub of innovation or a hub of technology or a hub of education. And of course, it's none of those things, and certainly not a hub of manufacturing or anything else. And that's why you continue to see these European leaders who are beholden, their loyalty is to the institutions they sit upon, right? The legacies they come from, the narratives that they hold. That's why they still cling to the American Empire. And that's why they're so upset with the idea of Donald Trump maybe doing something different with the American Empire and the Europeans losing the good thing they once had by being the first among the American vassals.
Yeah, and you know, you did mention something about the fact that this has been used many times, and it just made me think, as an American, and I'm sure you thought the same thing, this is the same lie we got about Vietnam. It's the same lie that we got about Iraq. It's the same lie that we got about, you know, Syria and Libya and all of these other places. And they just, they feed us the same BS, and the Europeans are trying to do that with their populations right now. And this whole fear of Russia thing seems absolutely ridiculous. I mean, you know, not to necessarily give Russia undue props, because they have their own issues as well, just like every other country. But the idea that Russia needs for any reason to invade Europe, I mean, this is like, I don't know, I'm trying to come up with an example here, saying that an elephant for some reason needs to wake up this morning and squish a beetle. I mean, Russia is huge. Russia has more resources than any country in the world. Russia has more land than any country in the world. Why the hell does it want Denmark?
Right, right. I mean, and Russia doesn't even want Ukraine, per se.
No.
It's this war has been limited to the Russian-speaking parts of Ukraine for that reason. And there's also a lot of people who would say, look, if it's taken Russia all this time to conquer 20% of Ukraine, how the heck are they ever going to conquer, you know, how are they ever going to reach Warsaw, let alone Berlin and Paris, and then cross the channel to London? You reminded me, Rick, one time I sat down and I wrote down on a piece of paper all the various people I have been told in my lifetime was the next Hitler, right? And the list stretched halfway down the page, and some people made multiple appearances, you know, at multiple times. Saddam Hussein was the next Hitler, then Muammar Gaddafi at multiple times was the next Hitler. You know, I mean, but it is, it's a tried and true trope, this idea that you're going to scare your population into following you. And sometimes it works. Absolutely. Sometimes it works. There's that Hermann Göring quote from his time in prison at Nuremberg when he was asked about this, and he says it's very easy to manipulate, to paraphrase him, it's very easy to manipulate a population into to war. You tell them that they're about to be invaded, that the enemy's on the borders, and then anyone who, you know, resists that, you say that they're unpatriotic and in league with the enemy. I'm paraphrasing what Göring said, but people understand, right, this idea that we've seen this before. And they continue to go back to it. And this is one of the reasons why they're so afraid of information. They're so afraid of what we're doing here right now. This is why, to tie it back into the artificial intelligence, the project of AI being used to control the narrative, to determine history, to set the record. You know, Eric, I have used it, and it's incredibly problematic, but I was doing research for my work on the Iraq War, and it was giving back information that was just incorrect. And this is ChatGPT.
Yeah.
And then I asked it, what are its sources? And it says its sources were the biography of David Petraeus and the official record of the United States, official history of the United States Army in Iraq.
Petraeus.
And I said to ChatGPT, I said, what are you, crazy? Why are you using this? Why would you use this? And it said to me, Rick, the AI said to me, it said, because it has been programmed to defer to institutional authority rather than historical accuracy.
Wow, that's crazy. That's like saying that a guy who was a head coach in the NFL who was 1-31 over 2 years, however, he was famous because he became a talk show host or something like that, they're going to use him as a source, even though he lost. I mean, David Petraeus is a loser. He never won anything. He's a loser.
Well, let alone that biography was written by his mistress that he was convicted of passing top secret information to, right? I mean, so the whole thing is just, you know, talk about fruit from the poison tree.
Yeah, no, and nothing. You know, when you're absolutely right. When I use ChatGPT, obviously, to look for stuff, and I look and see what the sources are. And you're right. It's New York Times. It's CNN. It's Reuters. It's you know, The Guardian. It's the same old crap. And in very few cases will they put anything from this part of the world in their sourcing material. Speaking of this source part of the world, let me ask you about the war in Ukraine. I'm a little concerned that I talked about this yesterday about poking the bear. How often can you poke the bear before the bear finally growls and bites you? And right now the Europeans are poking Russia pretty bad. They're killing children, they're attacking schools, they're bombing apartment buildings, they're doing a lot of really nasty stuff. Some of it, I guess you could say, if they hit like infrastructure for oil, I guess you could say that's related to the war, but a lot of this other stuff is just plain-ass terrorism, right? And nobody's calling it that, but that's kind of what we would call it if we saw it anywhere else. What do you think, what's your read of what guys like Lavrov and Putin are sitting around thinking about and what they might do? Because they seem really restrained so far to me.
Yeah, I mean, certainly their options are rather limited, right, in terms of what they can actually do. They could respond directly to the Europeans, but then that gets you into a war with NATO that you supposedly launched this war to prevent.
Yeah.
Right. So if one of the reasons for this war was a preventive war to prevent further NATO encroachment and an eventual war with NATO, then you've basically you know, delivered that to yourself. You also, too, you don't want to do what your enemy wants you to do.
Yeah.
And I think these attacks by Ukraine, this campaign, it has many reasons for it. And we have to give credit to the Ukrainians for building their industry, being able to conduct this campaign, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the idea, though, is that in the European capitals, as well as in the Ukrainian capital, and also, too, here in Washington, D.C., in many offices, the idea is that this is going to prompt the Russians into doing something that will allow us to come into the war, right? So you don't want to respond in a way that's going to do exactly what your enemy wants you to do. And so then what's the alternatives, as well as then the pressure that the Russians themselves are feeling from their own population? I mean, there's these comments in Russia that, it only took us 4 years to beat the Nazis. How come we're going into our fifth year now with the Ukrainians? Why aren't you fighting hard enough? And then for every time you have a college dormitory hit and 20 some odd college students killed, you have to respond. And this is where I think many of us have feared this war would get to, that it would turn into something similar to what occurred in the Iran-Iraq war, where neither side could defeat the other side militarily, and it becomes what was called the War of the Cities, where both sides just bomb and fire missiles at each other's cities in some vague hope of terrorizing the other side into submission, which is not going to happen. History tells us it's not going to happen. But then more so, it becomes an idea of like, look what they did to us, and look what we did to them in return. You can imagine where that gets to. And so I'm very concerned that this war has no end to it, that both sides muddle along, for lack of a better term, for years to come, and they adapt to it. They live with it, which is what countries do. You know, I mean, so and it's so hard to get good information on this,
hopefully not. I mean, what I'm hearing from Putin and others is, we got 10%, maybe 15% left in the Donbass. And once we get that, we're done, we're out, we'll be willing to do a deal. But we're not going to do a deal till every single person who we consider is an ethnic Russian, wants to be Russian, goes to Russian churches and speaks Russian, gets what they have asked us to give them, which is their Russian citizenship. And I think...
The problem is that the Ukrainians, and more so the Europeans, and many Americans, including most of the American Congress, won't allow for that. And so what will then become, when Russia takes, say, the entire of the Donbass will be the new Jerusalem for NATO, right? This will be that we were just talking about, God, the identity European politicians, right? And opposing Russia. And so this becomes, and so Russia may have this plan of, hey, once we get to the boundaries of the Donbass, that's it, we're shutting it down, this will enter into a frozen conflict. But I think there are many, many in the capitals of Europe, in Brussels, et cetera, who will not go with that, and they will only continue the war.
They need the war to continue because that's where they make their bread, you know?
Right, in many different ways, right? Yeah, in many different ways.
Matthew, thanks so much, man. What a wonderful conversation. You're such a smart guy. It's so nice to be able to have you on. If somebody wants to reach you or watch you, what do they do?
I'm on Substack. Just Google my name in Substack, and it'll come up. I'm also on Twitter, Matthew P. Ho, P as in Patrick.
Thank you so much. You've been so gracious with your time. And you know what? And thanks for the kind words, too. That makes me feel good.
It was absolutely terrific. I was nodding along. And again, you mentioned my past. I was in the Afghan war. I saw the NATO forces there. I saw what happened with regards to Libya. I went to Europe. I spoke to people who were opposed to NATO throughout Europe. And this is what I'm talking about 15 years ago now, 16 years ago. This is what they're saying. I was in Finland. I was in Sweden. And, you know, this idea that, say, particularly in Finland, that the Finns would join NATO. And when I was there in 2011 or whenever that was, this is what they're saying. This is the danger. This is what came from us taking part in Afghanistan.
Yep.
You now have this whole class of people that, as you said, this is where, right? This is where their bread comes from. Mm-hmm. And whether that is actual their income, their careers, or it's their political identity. And now here we are with the Finns saying, come on, bring in your nuclear weapons.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, bankers and weapons manufacturers. Those are the two people that they basically hang with. Thanks, Matthew. You're the best, man. Appreciate your time.
All right, thank you, Rick.
And that's it for this segment. But a reminder that you can usually find us on Spotify, and you can find us on X, and you can find us on YouTube when they're not trying to cancel my segments. By the way, most social media platforms answer to advertisers, just like what we were just talking about with Matthew right now. Those guys I put up on the screen a little while ago, they answer to processors, they answer to advertisers, and those are the people who decide what you get to read and what you get to hear and what you get to say. And that's horrible. So YouTube, by the way, is one of the worst. They recently canceled me and 120,000 followers. Somehow it's been built up again, and now we're up to about 20,000 again really fast. But it's kind of happened organically. And I guess if at some point they take me down again, they take me down. So what I've done is I put all of my stuff, in case you want to check it out, go over to BitChute. I've put all of my stuff there. So there you can see it. I think they're different. I tend to believe in them. That's my page there. They tend to answer more to you than to advertisers and to algorithms. Nobody is removed. No content ever disappears. So, and I do my live stream. In fact, I'm going to do one there in about a half hour, 1 p.m. New York or Miami time, where I talk to Ritter and Morandi and Johnson and hopefully Tucker soon again and, you know, that kind of stuff. So it's called BitChute. Check it out. I'm there, and you might find me there. So, as for now, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, in fact, for letting us into your homes. And thank you so much as well for commenting. It really means a lot. I go through what you write. I listen to what you say. And sometimes I agree, sometimes I disagree. But I appreciate the fact that you're taking time to tell us what you think about the stories that we cover. That's true. That's democratic. And that's what we're trying to achieve. I'm Rick Sanchez. Look for you next time.